I overheard something at a coffee bar the other day that that truly stopped me cold.
Oh, yeah.
A mother was talking to a friend, just completely distraught, because her 8-year-old had just been told she needs glasses.
Right. It's an incredibly common diagnosis now. It
Yeah.
seems to have shifted from being, a minority thing to almost the expectation.
That's it exactly. And that's what makes the doctor's observation so potent. She told this mother that when she was growing up, maybe 1 in 20 kids needed glasses.
Wow.
Now, in just one generation, it's jumped to more than half the population in a lot of areas. And this isn't genetics. This is a rapid, dramatic environmental change.
And that environmental shift is, well, it's basically the move from playing outside in natural daylight to being indoors, often with screens in structured activities.
And the mother's desperate question was the real heart of it. She asked, "Can we fix it? If we get her outside now, can it reverse the damage?"
And the answer is no.
The pediatrician said no. The critical window for proper eye development is before age 9. And if that window closes without the right input, the eyeball itself elongates. That structural change is permanent. It doesn't shrink back.
The structure is just locked in. We've optimized childhood for indoor safety and, academic achievement, and the irreversible consequence is the permanent impairment of a core sensory system. It's a shocking trade-off.
It is. So that's the big question. If we accidentally broke an entire generation's eyes without even realizing it until it was too late, what else are we breaking?
What are the capacities?
Exactly. Resilience, social skills. Things we won't discover are gone until that irreversible window has long since closed. And that is the mission of this deep dive. Understanding the irreversible cost of a modern, optimized childhood.
To really get a handle on the permanence of this, we have to start with the science of why this early input matters so much. We call them critical periods or sensitive periods.
Okay, let's unpack that. What makes a critical period different from just, regular learning time?
Think of it like a temporary boost of extreme malleability in the brain. These are specific, pretty narrow windows where the nervous system is maximally plastic for certain types of learning.
Like language or vision.
Exactly. During that phase, learning is rapid, it's automatic, it's robust. But if you miss it, trying to learn that same skill later becomes exponentially harder, slower, and often incomplete.
That makes perfect sense, but it also raises a question. Why would the brain do that? Why not just stay maximally plastic forever?
Because the brain needs stability. As Dr. Hubert Chen often points out, keeping that high level of plasticity is metabolically really expensive. It's costly
And unstable.
and unstable. To build complex abilities, to go from recognizing sounds to writing poetry, you need a stable foundation.
Sure.
So the brain gradually locks in what it's learned early on. It sort of sets the concrete so you can build on top of it.
So the brain is being adaptive. It's looking at the early environment, assuming that's the world it needs to survive in, and then it optimizes for that reality.
Precisely. And that's adaptive if the environment you're in is representative of the world you'll actually live in. But here's the trap.
Right.
If that early environment, the indoor, structured, screen-filled reality of today's childhood, is not representative of the real, unpredictable world, the brain locks in the wrong optimizations. The capacity is lost because the critical period closed on a suboptimal setting.
And the most measurable, most concrete example of this trap is the myopia epidemic. Let's just dive back into those statistics because they are genuinely alarming. In 1970, maybe 1 in 4 Americans was nearsighted. By 2020, that's up to over 42%.
And if you look at dense urban areas in Asia, say Seoul or Singapore, the rates can be staggering. We're talking exceeding 80% nearsightedness in young adults.
It's a public health crisis that happened in 40 years. It has to be environmental.
It is. And we often blame screens directly, but Dr. Lisa Patel's research clarifies that the real villain isn't the close focus of the phone, it's the lack of the right kind of light.
So what's the mechanism there?
The key variable is the intensity of natural daylight. Our sources emphasize that kids need at least 2 to 3 hours a day of outdoor time before they're 9 years old.
2, 3 hours.
When the eye gets exposed to that bright, natural light, it triggers a release of dopamine in the retina. And that dopamine acts as a chemical signal. It basically tells the eyeball to stop elongating.
So the dopamine is the brake pedal for eye growth.
It's the brake pedal, exactly. If that trigger is chronically missed during that critical window, the eyeball just keeps growing too long. And that's myopia. And like we said, once the structure is set, there's no known way to shrink a pathologically elongated eyeball.
Which means we're now dealing with an irreversible structural change at a population level. And it's not just about thicker glasses. High myopia seriously increases the lifetime risk of retinal detachment, cataracts, glaucoma.
All very serious conditions. It's a permanent subtraction from a generation's health.
Right. Which naturally leads us to the losses that we can't measure with an eye chart. What about foundational cognitive and social skills? We need to talk about the free play collapse.
The numbers on this are almost unbelievable.
They really are. In 1981, 85% of kids played outside daily without an adult watching them. By 2021, that's down to around 35%.
And the time spent just plummeted from 3 or 4 hours a day to less than half an hour.
Less than half an hour.
Yeah. And the assumption was that, you know, organized sports and extra classes would replace the value of that time. But unstructured, self-directed, kind of semi-risky play, especially between 5 and 12, that's where you build the core skills for being a resilient adult.
What specifically happens in that unstructured time that structured activities just don't provide?
It's the spontaneous negotiation. Kids develop executive function, emotional regulation, social skills.
Mm-hmm.
All when they argue and self-organize and make up rules for games.
Like who gets to be the dragon.
Exactly. Or how a magic spell works. They practice navigating conflict without an adult immediately jumping in to fix it. It's basically a lab for handling ambiguity.
So what happens when that lab time is just gone? Replaced entirely by adult-run activities. We're seeing this generation hit young adulthood now.
Right.
What are people observing?
Well, Jordan Lee, who works in this area, notes a real struggle with anything that is unstructured. If you give these young adults a clear set of steps, a rubric, they can perform exceptionally well.
Okay.
But if they face an ambiguous problem where they have to create their own structure or resolve a conflict without a clear right answer, they often freeze. They just never practiced it.
They're optimized for the track we laid out, but when the track runs out, they just stop.
Right.
That shifts us perfectly into our next two crucial but often invisible windows that are closing.
Let's start with the development of intuition. This happens primarily during Piaget's stage of concrete operational thinking, roughly ages 7 to 11.
And this is the stage where learning has to be physical, right? Building things, breaking things, mixing, sorting. It's the foundation of embodied intuition.
Yes. If you don't engage the physical world, you miss the chance to build a foundational understanding of real-world physics. It's the difference between seeing a diagram of water displacement versus actually feeling the weight of the water and watching it slosh over the side.
You mentioned Marcus Ozé, the master carpenter, and his accounts really drive this point home.
He finds that his apprentices, kids in their 20s who missed this period, they often lack a foundational intuition for how materials behave.
What does that look like in practice?
They understand intellectually that, say, wood splits along the grain, but they have no felt sense of it.
Yeah.
They don't intuitively know how much force to apply before it snaps. They have to rely on formulas and checklists for everything.
They lack that automatic judgment that comes from years of just messing around with stuff. So an 8-year-old playing with sticks and dirt builds that intuition for free, but a 25-year-old has to try and learn it cognitively.
And the learning curve is dramatically steeper. It connects directly to our second point here. The critical window for fear calibration generally ages 3 to 8.
We thought keeping kids perfectly safe was the goal. Soft matting on every playground, eliminating climbing risks. We were acting out of love, but maybe we were actually disabling the system that determines safety.
We were disabling the amygdala. Think of the amygdala as your brain's smoke detector. That critical period requires exposure to manageable risks. Climbing a little too high, roughhousing, scraping a knee to train that smoke detector.
To teach it the difference between scary but safe and actually dangerous.
That's it. So if your childhood is pristine and totally controlled, what happens to the smoke detector?
It becomes hypersensitive.
It never learns to filter. So when that person encounters a challenge as a young adult, public speaking, a tough boss, the amygdala just screams danger because it was never calibrated.
That is a direct line to the high rates of chronic anxiety we see today. The wiring needed to tell the difference between uncomfortable and existential threat, it was never laid down.
And that kind of anxiety is incredibly hard to treat because you're trying to rewire a system that should have been set automatically years ago.
So we've arrived at the central, you know, the central anxiety of this deep dive. Are these losses truly irreversible? If you missed the window for fear calibration or physical intuition, is that capacity gone forever?
Well, the science of adult neuroplasticity shows us the brain can always change. But we can't yet say you can fully compensate for capacities missed during a critical period.
This brings us back to the classic analogy of language acquisition. I think that's really helpful here.
It is. An adult can learn a second language after 12, but they'll almost always have an accent. The process is slower. It's far less intuitive than for a native speaker. The learning is functional, but it's not optimal. It costs a lot more conscious effort.
And Jordan Lee's work confirms this. When they run remedial programs for young adults, teaching them play, teaching them risk-taking at age 25, it works. Anxiety goes down, confidence goes up, but it's always harder, it's slower, and it's fundamentally more cognitive.
Yes. The 25-year-old has to use their frontal lobe, their conscious reasoning, to manage the risk.
Mm.
The 7-year-old learned it automatically, viscerally, through play. That difference in cognitive load, that is the irreversible cost.
The energy it takes just to be a competent, resilient adult is exponentially higher because they missed the free learning period. So the question has to shift from how do we fix this to how do we fiercely protect the windows that haven't closed yet?
And we have concrete, actionable strategies for that, drawn from the consensus of these experts.
Mm-hmm.
The first, most urgent, is protecting that outdoor time, those 2 to 3 hours of natural light daily for every child who hasn't hit age 9 yet.
That has to be a non-negotiable health mandate.
It does. Second, preserve unstructured play. We need to normalize being bored. Not everything needs a schedule or an educational outcome. Kids need time to invent their own worlds.
Third, preserve hands-on physical learning. Prioritize cooking, building, fixing things. Real physics over digital physics.
Absolutely. And fourth, preserve real connection. Time for bodies in proximity, for unmediated conversations that aren't routed through a screen.
You know, if we connect all these sources, they suggest we've already lost some profound things as a culture. The capacity to be truly bored, the capacity for genuine surprise in a world of algorithms, and maybe most crucially, the skill of navigating uncertainty without immediately looking up the answer.
That's the ultimate trade-off, isn't it?
Yeah.
We're losing these essential human capacities, our sensing bodies, our intuition, not because tech is making us better, but because we're becoming more machine-like. We're outsourcing our judgment, our feeling, our risk assessment.
The challenge then is reframed. It's not some grand societal overhaul. It's a daily deliberate choice we all make. Am I going to be human or am I going to be a very efficient machine?
And the solution is found in those small, repeated, inefficient acts.
Choosing to feel discomfort instead of managing it away. Sitting with boredom instead of filling the void. Practicing something slowly. And for the next generation, letting children climb a little higher than we'd like and figure it out for themselves.
These small acts protect the capacity to be present and embodied. The goal is just to maximize the time those windows stay open.
I want to go back to that mother at the coffee bar. She recognized the irreversibility of the eye damage, but her final statement was this declaration of choice. She said, "I can't fix her eyes, but I can get her outside every single day from here on. I can let her take risks. I can preserve what's left."
And that fierce protective vigilance over the windows that haven't yet closed, that is the defining challenge for all of us today.
So the challenge for you, the listener, is simple and direct. Close your laptop, put your phone down, notice what you notice, feel what you feel, be bored for a moment, be present, be human. That intentional choice to embody your life is enough.